Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I thought I'd try something new. Hi, welcome to Murder in the Land of Oz. My name's Jess.
And my name's Ellen. Do you know, I was in the shower today and I was thinking, Jess and I need like an opening for the podcast, you know, like an opening that's mostly the same every time.
Like what?
Definitely not what you did today.
I don't know. I just like saying it. Anyway, welcome to our latest episode of Murder in the Land of Oz. Yes. How are you, Ellen?
I'm good. I've been better.
Great. Same. Woo! I'm up. I've had Coke, no sugar. I'm ready. It's Ellen's turn tonight. And Ellen, what are you going to be talking about?
Tonight we are talking about the Main Family. I titled my document The Main Murders, but then I changed it because it's, you'll find out. In about 1 hour and 15 minutes, you should know why. So I picked this topic because I've known about the Main Family for 8 years or 9 years or so.
Jeez.
And I thought everybody did. Certainly when you Google them, lots of stuff came out.
Lots of stuff comes
you
up.
You and also every person you've spoken to hasn't known who the Mains are.
I knew who the Mains were.
You know, from the play?
The play, but also working in, like I just, that, working in Brisbane City, Brisbane Arcade, yeah. Just knowing Brisbane about Arcade, the
yeah.
shop.
Yeah.
And then supposedly something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then I knew, anyway, we'll get into the bios
We'll get
later.
Into the stuff in the episode. We're going to say the things and then
the
everybody
things.
Will know about it.
Yeah.
That's how podcasts work.
But
welcome.
No, like I had a lovely Uber driver this evening. I'll just put it out there.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure his name is Richard and he just moved here from London in October and he's studying to be a police officer.
Ooh.
And I told him about the podcast and he was very intrigued from what I told him about the Main Family. He obviously didn't know.
Yeah.
But he was like, oh, we've got children. They're going to be, you know, we want them to go to school. And I was like, well, if they go to UQ, there's the Main building.
Yes.
I knew that bit.
Yes. Shout out to our homie Richard.
He is so lovely.
Welcome to Queensland.
And a great accent.
Yes. Very good. Very good. Okay. So let's get into it. The Main family are one of Brisbane's like establishing families. They are one of the groups of people that kind of built Brisbane. Again, talking about white history here. Sorry. People
yeah,
built
I,
this country for thousands of years.
I just realized that the other day. We're going to work on that. We're definitely going to work on that, okay?
Look, everybody's learning and educating.
Yeah.
At least we acknowledge it. We're trash.
Speaking of on that vein, I know we need to hop into this.
Mm-hmm.
But that gorgeous girl that got killed in Melbourne.
Yeah.
In the high rise.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, so news bulletin starts at 6. She wasn't on until like 6:45 or something, close to the end of the bulletin. And I was like, if that girl was white, it would have been the leading news story.
100%. There has been remarkably little news
and like then
coverage.
They're like, oh, it's the African gangs. It's like, pretty sure it was just some arsehole with a knife.
Exactly.
Stabbing
also, African gangs aren't real.
No.
I
correct.
Mean, I'm sure there are African gangs about, but you know.
Oop. It's the sirens.
It's the sirens.
They're coming to get you.
They're coming to get us.
Okay, Main Family.
It's Malcolm Turnbull coming to get me because I said African gangs aren't real.
Podcast producer Zane was preaching, so.
Yes, we're all preaching.
I thought he was telling us to like move on.
This is a murder podcast, not a subtle political commentary podcast.
Anyway.
Anyway, the Main Family. So the Main Family Yes, established most of Brisbane, purchased a lot of Brisbane real estate, developed a lot of the institutions that we know and love today, such as the Brisbane Arcade, the Royal Exchange Hotel, if you're a fan of a $4 basic on a Wednesday night. And many, many other sort of Brisbane institutions, including the University of Queensland. Mm. They didn't establish it, but they purchased the land for the unit to donate to the University of Queensland. And yes, they were Richie Riches, but they always had a bit of a bad reputation and people thought that they were
cursed.
Yes. And that they were very mysterious. They would call them like the Mad Mains and stuff like that. The murderous Mains, the Mad Mains,
the main gang.
The main gang.
I don't know.
They didn't call them the main gang, but we will call them the main gang. That will be the title of this episode. Hashtag where's your main gang? So the reason why they had this bad reputation throughout their lives is because of the Main family patriarch, Patrick Main, who came to Australia, like all the whites, mostly from Ireland in 1841.
County Tyrone.
Thank you, Jess. Did you just get the Wikipedia page up really quickly on your phone?
Maybe.
I've written the podcast. It's okay.
I want to shout out to my home.
It's also my home country. He was also a Catholic. We keep on doing episodes about Irish Catholics. Write what you know.
Yeah.
So he came over 1841 from Ireland. He lived in poverty in Ireland. He was an orphan. He had a bunch of siblings. Classic Irish story. Tell somebody who cares, Patrick Main. Came over at 17. He worked off his debt to his sponsor at Liverpool Plains for 2 years as a labourer. He then moved north in search of work, and he came to the settlement of Moreton Bay, which is here where we are right now, Murder in the Land of Oz.
Yay!
So Brisbane, this is even earlier in time than our previous episode, the Gatton Murders, so even less established. So Brisbane wasn't really like a city. It was more like a collection of buildings that were vaguely in the same geographic location. You couldn't cross the river. You had to like get a boat.
Row?
Yeah, you'd have to row. I honestly was reading about all this and they were saying like, yeah, there was no way to cross the river. And I was like, then how did anybody know anyone? How did anything get done? Like, how was there like trade at Kangaroo Point and then also trade at Queen Street? They're like on opposite parts of the river. And then I remembered that boats exist. Which is incredibly embarrassing because my father is a boat builder and I have been around boats my entire life. I was very puzzled. I never said that I was smart, just that I could Google.
Yep.
Yes. So he came to Brisbane that was not very populated. The population was mostly labourers and ex-convicts with a few posh British folks, just a couple thrown in for good measure. Women were few and far between, so very few of these men were in settled relationships, which meant that usually they would just go to work, you know, old-timey labour stuff, hoeing fields and things, I don't know, and then get drunk at the pub in the evening. Which is also what we do. Yeah. Working habits is not, minus the working in the field part.
We work in another type of field. The retail field.
A much worse field. I would rather like sow wheat or whatever.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't.
That's a lie.
Yes, that is a lie. So after coming north in search of work, Patrick Main, young, ambitious, and allegedly built like a brick shithouse. Every single page of the book was like, Patrick Main, tall and strong. Patrick Main, he was really big. Patrick Main, so just a really big unit.
We get it.
I was like, okay, he's big. Got it. He starts working at Campbell's Slaughterhouse and Boiling Down Works in Kangaroo Point.
Yikes.
He earned a lofty £1 a week.
Whoa.
Yes. Hey, big spender. A Boiling Down Works, if you don't know, because I didn't know because I'm a lifelong vegetarian and stuff like this grosses me out, but it's where they like boil down the leftover parts of the animal once they've butchered it to make like – to like render the fat and extract tallow that makes soap and candles and
fuck hell
axle grease and other stuff that they would use back in that day. So for the butcher boys and all the other workers around Kangaroo Point, the location of choice for getting drunk at the end of the day was the Bush Inn.
Ooh.
Everybody would get together there for a drink and a chat and other old-timey Aussie activities like games of two-up or what have you. So for Patrick Main, coming from harsh pre-Irish famine conditions to, you know, getting a pound a week, hanging out with the mates.
Sweet deal.
Sweet deal. Yeah, really sweet
deal.
Happy
to be there.
Yes, very happy. But in 1846, however, the owner of the slaughterhouse, John Campbell, ran out of money. The workers sued him for lost wages, which they were awarded. Patrick was paid around £6 and then sued Campbell again when his promissory notes for around £12 were dishonored, which means basically his check bounced.
No.
He was like, yo, give me my money. And he's like, yeah, I got your money. Then he gave him the money and then he went to deposit at the bank, but he didn't because there were no banks, but check bounced.
No.
So he sued again, got a little bit more money. So deeply in debt, Campbell was forced to sell the slaughterhouse and the premises were purchased by a man named Richard Smith. So life continued as usual for Maine until Smith then moved the slaughterhouse to Goodna in 1848 and Maine and the other workers went with him. It was there that Patrick Maine met Mary McIntosh, who he married on the 9th of April,
Mary
1849.
McIntosh,
Mary
Patrick
McIntosh.
Maine.
How could you get
How
more
could you
Irish?
Get more Irish? My God.
You can't. He met two other men down in Goodna who had become lifelong friends, Darby McGrath and Patrick Pacey.
Darby. I like that name.
I liked it too. McGrath was a former convict and Pacey was an Irish political rebel, so he was in familiar company. Darby McGrath, despite his troubled life, was determined to make something more of himself. He purchased large amounts of land in the Moreton Bay region and became increasingly wealthy. One of the area's richest men. Probably meant he laid £2 to everybody else's £1.
Yeah, he's like, I got £4. How many pounds
have
you
me,
got?
Look at me, big spender. This had a big impact on Patrick Maine, who learned from McGrath that wealth came easily if you had lots of property. Maine also learned.
That seems to me like wealth is easy if you have wealth.
But if you buy property and then like you graze cattle or sell it or build a building and then rent it, like you can purchase a plot of land for say £1 and then you can make more pounds from that £1. Money can be exchanged for goods and services.
What's that from?
The Simpsons.
Yes, that's right.
So Maine was like hanging out with my friends, loving it, sick of the bush, moves back to Queen Street with his, well, he moves back to Brisbane with his wife, Mary, who is pregnant with her first child. In 1849, he purchased the goodwill of a butcher's shop in Queen Street, which is Brisbane's main shopping thoroughfare. Interestingly, people believe that this butcher's shop is where Zara is.
Ah.
So keep that in your mind if you're from Brisbane.
That is in my mind.
In a few short years, Maine had gone from a penniless orphan from Ireland to the owner of a business in Brisbane's most prominent area. He had moved substantially up in the world. As a property owner, he was now on the electoral roll and he became an active member of the Brisbane community. He was also raking in the dosh. With his increased financial security, he acted as a guarantor for a number of Irish wannabe publicans. And as you can imagine, owning a butcher's shop and getting money from a bunch of pubs in the 40s is making bank. He had so much money, he didn't even know what he lacked in technical education. He made up for in business savvy. But despite his newfound place in society, he was still a bit of a rough man. He went afoul of the law a few times. He assaulted a man who entered his property in search of a pig that he thought Maine had stolen.
That's a lot to do for a pig.
Mm-hmm. The guy found the pig slaughtered in the yard and squared up to Maine, who promptly beat the shit out of him.
Because he was as strong as an ox.
Because he was as strong as an ox. He had the strength of a raging fire. Mysterious as the dark side of the moon. I felt it like
Mulan,
important.
If anybody didn't know that.
Yeah, I felt important to add that Maine like didn't go out and steal this guy's pig and just like wandered into the yard and Maine was like, find his keepers. I'm not going to not slaughter this pig. I'm a butcher. Like he's not, wasn't a pig thief, just a somebody who would assault
didn't
you.
Didn't do a takesies backsies.
He did not do a takesies backsies. He also had an interesting run-in with a police officer. So Patrick Maine was hanging out at the front of his butcher shop greeting passers-by.
I love that Ellen along with that, even though you can't see because we're recording a podcast, but she did like a tip of her hat.
I did tip my hat. I did tip my hat. So he's hanging out the front of his shop, tipping his hat Ellen style to passers-by. Constable Monsell walks by, like escorting a guy who had had one too many and was being a bit drunk and disorderly. And Patrick Maine attacked the police officer and again, just like beat the shit out of him.
Why?
And the courts later were like, why did you do that? And he was like, I didn't approve of the constable's actions. Okay. So because he didn't approve, he didn't approve of the constable's actions. So I think he had like a moral objection about walking
drunk people
home. Also, maybe he just hated cops. Which, I mean, most people at the time.
I mean, he was Irish.
Yeah. And it was also like the 1840s.
Oh, you're a cop.
oh.
Is that your impression of somebody? Okay.
I don't know. Never mind. I don't know. Onward.
Onward and upward. So he definitely had a hair trigger temper, and in his later years, he gained a reputation for threatening people with a whip when he didn't get his own way. He would be like, do that or I'll whip ya.
Well, whip can I just say, shape. Not that I would ever use a whip against anybody, but Sidetrack Nation, a Monday. Okay, so I don't know, like, Ellen and I both work in retail. We both have other things to do in our lives as well, like doing this podcast. And we had this
That's
girl.
That's about it though.
Yeah, pretty much. This girl who also works in retail decided to come into the store at 6:30, try everything on. We couldn't get her out of the store until 6:25, 25 minutes past close. And then when finally she'd bought the shit and she's standing at the front of the store, she's like, oh, do I want a bag? Do I not want a bag? Do I want a bag? I wanted, like, that in a moment is when I would want a Patrick Main style, like, get a whip
get
out
a whip
and be
and
like,
just be like, I'm going to use this.
Get out.
What are the cops going to do? Arrest me? I'll just beat them. That's what you can do when you built like a brick shit house, apparently. You can just.
Not that I want to be Patrick Main and I don't want to hurt one.
No, hurting is
maybe
bad.
Just like threateningly
with a whip. Fine.
Like, crack the whip to the right, you
yeah,
know?
Like Catwoman. Yeah. Just like do like a big flourish in the air and whack that shit down.
Yeah.
Customers Good. Beware.
Yeah, beware.
People in general, beware.
Beware.
Yeah, so he had back to Patrick Main. He had quite a few run-ins with the law throughout his life. He was fined £10 for trying to threaten a witness in some case. Ooh. He was fined for using bad language, which I just feel like is overly harsh. Come on, man. It's 1849. Australia.
Everyone's smelly.
Everybody's smelling and like swearing and throwing babies Drinking. In rivers and stuff. I don't know Ugh. Where that came from.
Where'd you hear that?
I don't know. Just words came to my mouth that right. weren't connected to my brain.
Okay.
And he was charged with assaulting yet another random passerby at his shop. So obviously because Patrick Payne was rich, fines didn't really deter him much. So he was like, oh, fine, whatever. I'm a baller. And also because Australia's relationship with criminals is not probably more friendly than most places. We do love a crim. So
the public love a crim. Yeah.
The public love a crim. Yeah. So people like that Main, he does threaten to whip people and stuff. Some people like that Main, he threatens to whip people and beats up passers-by, but he's a good time. Other people are like, I think something's mentally wrong with this person. Find out which group find of people was one. Right in the rest of this episode, beginning right now. So Patrick Main, petty criminal, successful businessman, he really wanted to be like one of the big men on campus. He was getting super rich, partly in fact due to the fact that Brisbane had a huge like population boom right after he bought his butcher shop. The population tripled or something like that.
Whoa.
Because three shipfuls of Irish settlers arrived like in that late 1840s, early 1850s. So from like, I think didn't write down the numbers because I'm not a professional, but it went from like 2,000 to 1,000
That's
people
mental.
In Brisbane. Yeah, huge population boom.
You own a butcher shop, bunch of Irish people.
I know, right?
Need your and beef pubs, stew.
And pubs.
That's true.
Irish people, stews and pubs. That's part of why he was just like so damn rich. He also put some of his money behind civic causes around Brisbane, but not necessarily out of the goodness of his heart. He would put them towards, I don't know if you could write off charitable donations in your taxes in 1849 Brisbane.
Neither.
Population around 6,000 or something.
Maybe.
But he would do things like he and a bunch of other
Brisbane.
I went to say Brisbane businessmen, but I accidentally combined it into like businessmen, which
business.
I think is awesome.
That's a new word. Hashtag business.
Businessmen. So they put some money towards like a reward for anybody that found gold on lands that they own. So like the rich businessmen were like, if you find gold on my land, you get this reward. But nobody ever took up on it.
Would there be gold here?
Yeah, there was a gold rush. There was a very famous gold rush.
I know in general in Australia there was a gold rush.
Yeah, so the gold rush
I'm
was
not
happening.
A dickhead.
And people were like, maybe there's gold up in
but
our hills
was there
as well.
Much gold found here in Brisbane?
Well, they never claimed the reward. So
no.
No.
Fuck off. I know about the gold rush. Mate, I know I'm a pretty face, but I'm not an idiot.
You're not an idiot, and you're incredibly beautiful. please, we're very sensitive at the moment. I'm sorry, listeners. So even though the reward never went claimed, his donation kind of put him up on a list with the other big boys in town, kind of being like, these are the important guys to watch out for. The ones who want you to find gold are the, you know.
They're the big
They're the
bosses.
Movers and shakers. He kept on investing in property, both rental and commercial. All told, he ended up owning land totaling around 1,700 acres, not including all of his commercial enterprises.
What?
Mm-hmm. He bought land in all the Brizzy hotspots, Elizabeth Creek and Margaret Streets, North Quay, Wickham Terrace, Breakfast Creek, Edward Street, Stanley and Vulture Streets in South Brisbane, and also the street that I live on, which I'm going to name.
Whoa.
He owned property on my street.
And my mother works in...
Sick.
Cool story, bro. Tell cool again.
He bought more hotels in town. It was around this time that he was bought up the RE and a few other pubs in town. Made most of his money from renters and returns on his land investments. He bought a huge property, 693 acres at Moggle, to begin grazing his own cattle to then send his butcher's shop to slaughter. So he was making that money. And he would also, I think I remember reading that he would also like give other butchers like his cattle as well. So... Well, that cattle being slaughtered, Maine did it.
He's fucking getting that dollar though, isn't he?
He was. He was getting a lot of cash. He still wanted to be more of a high roller. He was, as I mentioned before, he was a bit of a fan of a town improvement project. He was part of a group that campaigned for the like rough dirt roads that like were what like George Street and like William Street were made out of to be smoothed out so businesses could transport stuff easier. Because it'd be easier for the horses to ride and stuff like that. Yeah. So what's what I mean? That he's like, Brisbane needs smooth roads. We don't need dirt tracks anymore. But it's basically so that he could get his own
stuff. For his own benefit.
Yeah, for his own benefit. For everybody's benefit, but also for my benefit, but which mainly is most important. But mostly me. So he was a part of quite a few like important businessmen in town issues, but he was never really like on the top of the list. People still thought of him as a bit of a, like a rough rednecky kind of guy, which is like a bit hypocritical since
cashed
they were
up bogan.
He was literally a cashed up bogan, and everybody's we'll take your money, but we're not gonna respect you.
No.
Essentially,
it's like that new money debate thing.
Yeah, exactly. He got on board with a lot of like various election campaigns and stuff like that, and would support other important men to get elected when it suited him. And he was also part of like the separatist movement. So Queensland at the time was a part of the colony of New South Wales. And most people in Queensland were not happy about the slowness and inaction of the government down south, which fair enough.
Yeah.
Letter
probably took like 12 weeks.
Yeah. So his signature is on like the piece of paper that was like, we the people of Queensland or whatever want to not be New South Wales.
Right.
Yes.
There you go, Origin fans.
Yeah, take that. He was never the most important or the most respected, but he was definitely one of the most present. There wasn't a committee or an issue that Patrick Mayne wouldn't attach himself to. So on the 10th of December, 1859, the colony of Queensland, with a population at this time around 30,000.
Wow. So that's jumped up so much.
It's jumped up. Yeah. My initial numbers may not have been correct. I did make them up. Zane's laughing at us. He's like, oh, the girls are
these
not very
professional.
These bitches,
I gave them a podcast and now they're making up shit.
So on that day, Queensland was declared separate from New South Wales. So with the establishment of like the new colony of Queensland also came the need to establish a municipal council for Brisbane, and Mayne wanted to be on that council. So he hitched his wagon to a more prominent Brisbaneite named George Raff, who planned to stand for the Queensland Parliament. The two were both Irish Catholics and shared political interests. One project of theirs was to come up with a fund to subsidise the Brisbane National School. So Patrick donated £2 to the fund. And then...
Oh, Patrick, very generous.
Very, very generous. About $200-ish.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He's a baller though.
Yeah,
he
is a baller. £2? £2. It's not nothing. Somebody... One of the patrons for the school, who was also an Irish Catholic, his name was W.A. Duncan, was planning on leaving the school. And George Raff, knowing that they needed another Irish Catholic to take the guy who was leaving his place, put Mayne up to the job. So then Mayne donated another £100 to the school.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
And everybody was like, oh, Mayne, he's so generous. Oh, Patrick Mayne, don't you want to be on the Board of Education? And Patrick Mayne was like, fuck yeah, I do. So he did. So from there, when Brisbane was proclaimed as a municipality, Mayne was elected to the position of alderman along with many of the other business folk.
That's what I was about to say. I was about to say, wasn't he like an alderman or something? And then, but I was thinking that word, but then I was about to say ombudsman. I'm like, no, that's not the word.
No, he was an alderman. He was an alderman. Yes, and then he was also appointed to the government's Board of National Education in Queensland. So he was finally getting the recognition and the status that he thought he was deserved. But his appointment was not without controversy. People would say that Patrick Mayne was getting a bit too big for his boots.
Bit too big for his britches.
Yes, his wealth and status didn't mitigate his fiery temper or his rough upbringing. Despite the negativity, Mayne continued to throw himself into, is Fifi biting you?
Got such short claws. They're so sharp.
Phoebe's like, this episode excellent is boring. Podcast, when are you going to get to the Woo! Murder? Yes. Despite the negativity, Mayne continued to throw himself into his business and other activities. His appointment as alderman kept him very much in the thick of the town business. Brisbane didn't have much in the way of services or amenities, and the council was busy trying to set Brisbane up as a proper town. The role of alderman was unpaid, and as such, the businessmen who were on the council often had to miss work for council business and work, etc. And Mayne missed quite a few months of council business in 1861 and again in 1862 due to being away on personal matters, in sarcastic quotation marks.
Ooh.
And he did not do well in the re-elections in 1862 due to his absence, and his seat was taken over, but he ran again in 1863 for the seat of Fortitude Valley and was elected. At this point in time, he's been an alderman for a little while. He's enjoying himself. He's being like, you do this, you do that, my ideas are great, yada, yada, yada. But around this like 1863 period, his behavior at council was getting more erratic and belligerent. So even though he was never really the most even-tempered of men, his argumentative nature and tendency for like weirdly fixating on some issues that weren't important, like they wanted to get a fire bell and they said that the fire bell was going to cost £30 but actually cost £50, and he was like, take that bell back, we're getting another bell. And everybody was like, we need the fire bell, Patrick Mayne. Patrick Mayne was like, no, you told me it would be £30
and it was 50,
and it was 50. And everybody else was like, what's wrong with this guy? Yeah, so he wasn't really winning many favors with the other aldermen. He kept on missing meetings. He was very outspoken. He would personally attack other aldermen and was often confused about issues. Like he nominated one person for some role or something like that, and then he like seconded somebody else's motion of nominating another person. And everybody was like, but Patrick, you already put somebody up for the job. And he was like, what's going on? So by 1865, it was pretty clear to everybody else on the council that Patrick Mayne's erratic behavior was the result of. He attended his last council meeting on June 17th, 1865. He would spend the last 6 weeks of his life requiring round-the-clock care from a nurse. At this point, his finances were in shambles, but they were shamble-esque.
Right.
They had some shamble-ish characteristics. So wild speculation and poor investments plus a big old debt to the Bank of New South Wales had left him not penniless, but not pennyful.
Right.
He died on the 17th of August, 865. And now comes the juicy part. The murder part of the Murder in the Land of Oz podcast.
What? There's a murder? What?
There's a murder in this episode.
What?
It's not just facts about Brisbane. So for the vast majority of Patrick Mayne's life, gossip and rumor followed him about like a black cloud. How had this man, a rough, penniless orphan from Ireland, managed to amass the great fortune he had? How did he go from being a butcher earning £1 a week at a slaughterhouse to running his own business in the main street of town?
And look, fair question.
Fair question. Bits us.
If I ended up like quitting my job tomorrow and like getting on an airplane and, you know,
starting a new life in LA or something like that, I'd be like, something's gone down that I didn't anticipate.
Something's happened.
Yes. Well, for Patrick Mayne, the answer lies at the Bush Inn, Kangaroo Point, near the Clambull Slaughterhouse years
Remember
before.
That, guys? The Bush Inn? Remember that?
I'm constructing a narrative. I'm doing it poorly, but I'm constructing one.
I'm with you.
So on the morning of Saturday, March 26, 1848, a man was sailing down the Brisbane River with his family, and he spotted the lower half of a body lying in the muddy riverbank.
What?
Yep.
Lower half?
Lower half.
Like cut in half?
Loins down.
What?
Mm-hmm. Appropriately horrified, the man sailed on to alert the police. Constable Murphy and Constable Fitzpatrick.
I wonder where they're from.
Bloody Irish people. arrived on the scene to discover that the body was cut in two, with the lower half lying on the riverbank and the arms and the upper torso lying in the grass a few meters away. The head was not present.
Oh, that fucks me. Dismemberment fucks me. I hate it. I hate it so much.
I have to say I'm also not a huge fan of dismemberment.
I just can't take it.
So there was a deep cut on the right side of the chest that had severed the ribs and a smaller cut on the left side. Roused by the understandable commotion, a crowd began to form. Take a shot every time crowds form around crime scenes.
In Brisbane.
In Brisbane. Seriously, guys, wait for TV to get invented. So the crowd forms and everybody in the crowd was like, we'll help you guys search for the head. And the police officers were like,
no, thank you.
No, they were like, yeah, town. Come on, populace. Let's go search for the head.
Let's go.
So the head was eventually found.
Fifi is worried. She's like, guys,
you're having a very physical reaction. Jess is like writhing around in her chair like she's getting dismembered.
No thanks.
So the head was eventually found propped between two joists in an unfinished building across the road from the Bush Inn. Blood was discovered in the backyard of the Bush Inn, all over the fence, on the ground between the fence and the well. And it seemed like attempts had been made to wash the blood off the wall. Outside of the fence, the grass was crushed in two places as if somebody had thrown the two halves of the body over the fence.
What?
Blood was on the grass on the outside of the fence and blood marks were traced from the side of the fence to the riverbank where the body was found. There was also a copious amount of blood inside the well in the Bush Inn. The water was examined.
Ew, people had to drink that.
The water was examined and found to have blood in it.
Ugh.
And a portion of intestine was discovered.
Ugh.
As well as a knife, a towel, and three shirts, one that was missing a sleeve.
Oh.
Conveniently, the body on the riverbank had been found with a random shirt sleeve attached to it. So it was alarmingly evident that the murder had occurred somewhere in or around the Bush Inn.
Nah,
Murphy and Fitzpatrick
are
standing there like, look, policing's only been around for a few decades, but I'm pretty sure that it happened at
the
Bush Inn.
We would play them in this.
We would. If this was like a movie or an episode of Drunk History or something, we'd be the cops being like, oh, I wonder where the murder happened. Could it be here where the blood and the intestines are?
That's us. Copyright.
So a member of the crowd had identified the head as previously belonging to a man named Robert Cox. Robert Cox was a patron who had been drinking steadily at the Bush Inn for a few days in order to drink through a £4 money order he had given the public. Now, I don't know anything about money or inflation or economics or anything. But the Google tells me that £4 in 1848 is £396 in 2018 or $702 Australian dollars.
Fuck off. That's so much alcohol.
This guy had been in Brisbane for like 4 days and he was still smashing it. He's like, I've got to drink through this. I gave the publican £4. I've got to drink all £4. I've got to drink all $702 of this.
Like you wouldn't be able to do anything else. You wouldn't be able to sleep.
You wouldn't be able to sleep. Unless you're getting espresso martinis because they're expensive. But again.
Oh, like $18. Like go fuck yourself, press club. Like no way.
No. So he was not drinking espresso martinis. He was probably drinking like ale.
Yeah. Which is like what?
I tried to find out what like a pint cost in 1848 to find out exactly how much this guy had consumed. But I couldn't. The oldest information I could find was from 1952, which was nearly a century later. So I would, if you know.
How does it go? Like what's in a pound? Like a pound, you know, like a dollar, there's like 5 cents and 20 cents. Like what like small denominations are there in a pound?
Like pennies and shillings and stuff.
Pennies and shillings. Yeah. Wow. Like what if like a glass of ale was like half a pound? You'd be
so drunk.
We'd be like on the ground vomiting.
Honestly, I don't think, I mean.
Oh, I have a funny story.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Is it podcast appropriate?
Yeah. No, it was fine. Just about being drunk, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
I had an unfortunate incident a couple of months ago where mm-hmm. I got absolutely smashed on rosé mm-hmm. and red wine. And I was sick out the front of my building. So there's like smaller, there's apartments that have like car parks like right outside of it. And I sat outside these people's car parks that I'd never met before and had been sick onto their driveway, essentially their personal driveway. And I saw them, I looked them in the face for the first time today, and the mark was still on the ground from when I had been sick.
Oh my
I'd washed
God.
It up, but there still was like, you know what red wine does? It stains.
You full on Robert Cox did that night.
I full on Robert Cox that
night. You pulled the full Cox.
I pulled the full
Okay.
Yikes.
Yikes indeed. So Robert Cox was a former convict who was friendly with the cook at the Bush Inn, who was also a former convict.
Surprise.
Yeah. Australians being convicts.
What?
What? The cook's name was William Fife. Cox had come to Brisbane from the south where it was told to police by his travelling companion that Robert Cox had cut and sold 16 or 17,000 feet of cedar to a boatyard in Tweed. Smith said that Cox sold the timber for between 300 and 350 pounds, less 4 pounds, I assume, for the booze. So in 2018 Australian dollars, that's between $52,747 and $61,538.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. Also, don't know if my maths is right. If you know maths, please check me.
Yeah,
please
send
check
us an
myself
email.
Before I wreck myself. murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com. So as Cox had been getting steadily drunk at the Bush Inn for the preceding 4 days since he arrived in Brisbane, it was reasonable to assume that some of the other patrons had heard about the money. Patrick Mayne was among the men drinking at the Bush Inn on the evening of Saturday, the 25th of March.
Picking up what you're putting down.
The daughter of the owner of the pub, Charlotte Sutton, had overheard on Saturday afternoon Robert Cox drunkenly accusing his friend William Fife, the cook, of stealing from him. I wrote drunkenly accusing, but after you've been drinking for 4 straight days, there's no sober accusing. accusing his friend William Fife, the cook, of stealing from him, which Fife denied. Charlotte told her father about the interaction, and although nobody who worked at the pub actually believed that Cox had any money, it was an interesting story to tell the patrons of a night, being like, oh, that Cox, he made 300 to 350 pounds selling a bunch of cedar up the Tweed. So other patrons did know about it. So once all the pieces of Robert Cox's body had been discovered, the police took it to the Bush Inn to lay it out and begin a sort of autopsy. Another
That's
taking
nothing taking the body to the pub. Getting murdered. Everybody, don't do that. Don't take the body,
don't
to,
take
the
body
pub.
To the pub.
Okay? Don't do it.
So Dr. Kesey Cannon, a surgeon and interestingly named man, examined
Kesey.
The body.
Kesey?
How's possibly Casey. K-E-A-S-E-Y.
That's Casey.
Casey?
Yeah.
I've never heard it said like that before.
Kesey.
Kesey. Dr. Kesey Cannon.
Dr. Kesey Cannon.
Sorry to the Irish.
Sorry.
Examined the body and said that the abdomen had been cut open with a knife and that the body's spine had been severed with an axe. Oh. The body was so mutilated that he was unable to determine the cause of death. I think it could be
severing the spine.
Severing the spine due to axe.
Yeah.
It would be my
top of the
list. That's
what I'd
sign the death certificate as.
Yeah.
So during the investigation, Constable Murphy discovered in William Fife, the cook's room, a bloodstained towel, a bloodstained child's shoe, a piece of paper with bloodstains on it, and bloodstains on the floor underneath the bed. In the kitchen, he found burnt buttons and clothing burned to ash.
Ugh.
So a bunch of Bush Inn locals were arrested, including Fife, the cook. No prizes for guessing why there.
Yeah.
William Sutton, the owner, William Holt, who lived at the hotel, William Lynch, George Platt, and John Connell, who were some patrons of the night. So back in the day, Brisbane had like a little courthouse, but nothing that was like for like a serious.
Well, look, they took like the buddies to the pub, so I wasn't expecting them to have like a full on courtroom.
They didn't have a full on courtroom, no. It was
didn't
more like
a Broadchurch situation,
No, it was more of a like he stole my horse kind of situation. So all trials and such happened in Sydney. So as such, they assembled like a grand jury at the Bush Inn in order to examine the suspects and see if it was possible to send any of the arrested men down to Sydney to be tried. It seems to me a little like a game of Cluedo or some other murder mystery party where you're like, everybody help us find out who committed this crime. Like everybody's just going to the Bush Inn, finding body parts. Now they're
Let's
like, hey, do you want to be
head.
In this grand jury? They're like, sure.
It's like 4-year-old Maisie's like, I did it, mummy. I did it. I found the head.
Literally. So Sutton, the owner of the pub, told the constable that he thought Fife was responsible and that he saw someone who Sutton supposed was Robert Cox in Fife's bed around 11 o'clock of the night in question when Sutton was locking up and going to bed. So around 1 o'clock, Sutton was woken from his slumber by three patrons after a beer. the aforementioned William Lynch, George Platt, and our old friend Patrick Mayne.
Oi, there he is.
Fife was still up and about at this time, Sutton said. So the three men, so William Lynch and George Platt were butcher friends of Patrick Mayne. So the three butchers had been at the pub earlier in the evening, had left and come back for around two. So Patrick Mayne said that the three drank beer and wine until 3 a.m. at the pub, where they saw and heard nothing suspicious, and went back to Mayne's lodgings and kept the party going until 4 a.m.
What a rager.
Yeah, so Sutton said that Fife was up this whole time and asked Sutton for a glass of beer, saying, "That fellow Cox has gone." Knowing that the hotel and the gate had been locked at 11 and having seen Cox in Fife's bed after then, Sutton asked how he had left the premises. Fife responded in a not at all suspicious manner. He went over the gate at 12:30. He went over the gate.
I mean, so the evidence, I chucked him.
The evidence about Fife was stacking up. Witnesses maintained, however, that on the morning the body was discovered, that Fife seemed normal, collecting his laundry from the washerwoman without seeming like he had committed a grisly murder the night before. He also seemed normal to a witness named John Croft, who testified that the burnt button and clothing could not have been a result of Fife burning the evidence after the murder on Sunday morning, as this guy Croft got to the pub around 4:45 a.m. and the oven was cold.
Right.
So old-timey oven take up.
Fair enough.
And then cool down again.
Yeah.
But he was, on the other hand, seen cleaning out his room with cloth on the morning of, and he had asked Charlotte Sutton for a clean shirt.
Yes.
So the jury, the grand jury that assembled, brought
at
in a
pub.
At the pub.
Probably all pissed.
I think they conducted it semi, much like we conduct this podcast, they conducted it semi-professionally.
Yeah, we're not drunk right now.
We aren't right now. So the maybe grand jury later brought in a verdict of willful murder against William Fife, whereupon he was sent to Sydney, where he faced a real judge in a real court. In Sydney, Fife said that he could not be guilty because the clothes which he allegedly burned in the fire were apparently later found intact, and that there was insufficient evidence to suggest that his bedroom had been the murder scene, despite the fact that Cox was sleeping in there, due to the fact the police only found a few bloodstained items, which he attributed to his bleeding lip. Charlotte
Sutton, that's a lot of blood from your bleeding lip, hey?
Yep. Charlotte Sutton did say to the grand jury that his lips had been bleeding that morning, but yeah, not to be judgmental, but how much blood?
I mean, I cut my lip. It's not.
There certainly wouldn't be blood stains on the floorboards.
I don't know how I'd get it on a shoe.
I don't know either. He also said that initially on the Sunday, there was minimal blood found in his room, but the blood under the bed and on the stuff under the floorboards had been found on Wednesday, when his room had been open to anybody wandering around and therefore could not necessarily be linked to the murder. He also added, which I thought was a good point, "It has been stated in evidence against me that I washed and slept my sleeping room on Sunday, which was not usual. Had I seen the blood, I would have washed that first." So good on you, Fife.
Good on you, Fife. Also, Fife. The character in The Beast.
It was Fife. A little flute.
Fife.
Beating the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas. Great.
Excellent film.
Excellent film. Really. I think it has 100% on cinema, Rotten Tomatoes. So good point aside, in Sydney on July 4th, 1848, William Fife was hanged for the murder of Robert Cox.
No, he protested his innocence Fife.
To the very end. So he had, yes, he said he was innocent. He and Cox were mates. They had reconnected after their convict time had ended. And witnesses at the time who saw them together at the inn said that they were like brothers, but their relationship had somehow soured over the course of that 4 days.
I mean, he was drunk.
I mean, for 4 days straight, I'd get pretty sick of you if you were drunk for 4 days.
Yeah, you couldn't even take me for a night.
No, that was one of the best nights of my life. You were crazy.
I fell over and I split my chin open, and then you and Jacob were like, "Okay, see ya, bye."
That was a different night.
Which night are you talking about?
I'm talking about the night that you and I went out.
Which night?
You don't remember?
What night?
The night that you and I went clubbing. You're talking about Jacob's 21st. This is very interesting
I'm talking,
for our listeners.
Never mind.
Never mind.
I'm talking about the night where I fell over and I split my chin open, and
that
you
was Jacob's 21st.
You laid it out of there so fast.
Sorry. The shocking murder and mutilation of Robert Cox had terrified and excited the people of Brisbane at the time. For many years after the death, there were whispers that an innocent man was hanged for the crime. Some 20 odd years later, as he lay dying, Patrick Mayne, the butcher, the businessman, the owner of a considerable amount of Brisbane real estate, allegedly confessed to the murder of Robert Cox.
Jesus.
Supposedly for the purpose of stealing the money that Cox had made selling cedar to the boatyard. So the theory is this, that when they first arrived to the Bush Inn on that night, Saturday the 25th of March, the three butchers, Main, Platt and Lynch, heard the story of Cox's windfall. They left the bar to scheme and then came back in the wee hours to commit the crime. Not finding Cox immediately apparent in the bar, they drink with Sutton, the publican, for a while to elicit his whereabouts. Cox, in his drunkenness, has wandered from Five Sped into the backyard of the inn where the three roll up on him and split him in two with an axe.
Yep.
The body, when found, was said to have been expertly carved.
Like a butcher did it.
Like as if a butcher had done it. The dismemberment of the body and the severing of the spine would have been second nature to an experienced butcher like Main. He was also the only person who had been at the bar the night of the murder but not arrested. He lived close by to the bar but was not one of the people who showed up to help search for the head. He would have been able to plant blood evidence in Fife's room to frame him, if indeed it was a frame like Fife suggested, as he had access to copious amounts of blood from the slaughterhouse. Having stolen Cox's money.
Like cows or something.
Yeah, exactly. Having stolen Cox's money and murdered him, a savvy man like Patrick Main would have known to keep it secret until the public's memory of the event had faded. The reason then for the public's apparent dislike of Main and his bad reputation was not just to his rough nature, but due to the fact that he was a murderer. So we kind of have two options here. Was it Fife or was it Main? And I have issues with both.
Both. Eh?
Both possibilities are not quite right. Zane, can you please stop drinking your Slurpee while I'm trying to podcast? It's very distracting.
I'm so excited.
Firstly, why would Fife murder and dismember his friend and then throw the body parts all around the backyard like a big old idiot? Surely, surely as the one person at the bar who knew Robert Cox, he would have known that he would have been the prime suspect. There is a perfectly good Brisbane River 1 foot away from your door that you could just drown him in and kick the body out into float. So why would you dismember the body, chuck it over the fence, move it down the street, walk back up so there's a blood trail going from your backyard in the location in which you live and work, put your intestine particle and shirt particle in the well, which also has blood stains on it? Like, why would you do that, Fife, stupid person? But also, on the other hand, who could rock up to a crime scene, like a backyard of somewhere that was covered in blood and intestine parts, and be like, well, it can't have been the guy that lives here. So it's like, is
either
it,
he was
does
a
it help
old
him?
Idiot.
Otherwise, or he was mad, stupid, and a bad crim. Or somebody was setting
him up. Can I just say,
up.
Zane is crying with laughter. It's the best.
I'm actually being very serious. This is a serious podcast. Yeah, so it seems like overkill. And
just a tad.
Just a little bit.
The fact that there's intestines out, that's a lot.
Yeah, and like to cut that up, to sever the ribs, all that kind of thing. Questionable, questionable, questionable. Lemon questionable.
I had appendix surgery and that makes me like, gah.
Yeah, you weren't even like, you didn't even die.
No, I felt like I was dying.
Also, if he did indeed steal the 300 to 350 pounds, they never found it in his room. So it
oh,
is.
Fife. There was no sign of the money.
No, no money was ever found.
And like, where are you going to put it in 1840 something?
Yeah,
you know?
When you live in a room in a pub, you know what I mean? And yeah. They did search the pub. So if Maine was the one that did it, if Maine and his butcher mates roll up and are like, okay, we're going to kill Cox, we're going to smash a few beers first, but then we're going to go kill this guy. Wouldn't Fife, the cook, who Sutton testified was awake the whole time, have heard them
the
do
murder,
it?
The murder, if the room is there, definitely.
Yes. So it's in the backyard of the bush inn. Dismemberment, not the quietest of activities.
Definitely not. No.
You'd think you'd scream.
You'd probably.
Yeah. So, I mean, why didn't anybody else, like the Charlotte Sutton or the other, the guy who owned the pub, nobody
and like
heard
how far
anything?
Away were the because you said Main lived nearby, so surely yeah. There would have been other houses.
You'd think so. But I think by nearby, they didn't necessarily mean like the next set of apartments. Yeah. I think they just meant in kind of geographic location.
Right.
Yes. So also the bloodstains that were found in Fife's room when he was allegedly, you know, sleeping in there, it could. If it was Patrick Main who put the bloodstains there, so like he's murdered Robert Cox, walked back in covered in blood because he would have been like dripping for yeah. There to be bloodstains. Again, Fife up and about at this point in time, not hearing or seeing anything, not being like, look at these bloodstains on my floorboards that I didn't put there. Iffy, questionable. Also, one point that makes people think that it was Patrick Main was the fact that the doctor said that the body had been carved expertly, but this is just my speculation. It could have been like, yeah, A, how do you sever something into expertly? Was it particularly clean? Was it neat? Like, did it look like somebody had done it before? Or was it just like a okay-ish cut? It wasn't mangled or anything like that. Because you know else who knows how to cut meat? Cooks. So that doesn't really lean me to think any particular way. So who done it? Another issue is that Patrick Moon was there with two mates. Did they help?
Did they split the meat?
Did they split the money? Did they become weirdly rich and famous inexplicably? I'd like to find out. I don't know how. Did they just help Maine out because they were being bros? Maybe they didn't know about the money. Maine just got them into it. And then another question is whether or not Cox actually ever had any money to begin with. So he was supposed
to have this 300, big old fibs.
So first and foremost, supposed to have 300 to 350 pounds, but he wouldn't have had 300 literal pounds because there were no banks.
No.
So he would have had like a note of paper that said like, I owe you 300 pounds. So Sutton and his daughter thought that basically Robert Cox was telling a big old lie when he said that he'd sold all this and stuff like that. Also, who can cut 16 to 17,000 feet of cedar and just get all the money to himself?
Yeah.
Nobody else helped him. How long did that take him? 8 years? Like, how long? It's a laborious job.
She said laborious.
It's the second time I've said laborious this episode, actually.
Look at that.
I've read the dictionary. No, I haven't. And there was a blacksmith named Joseph Lydiard who gave evidence that Cox had told them on the Saturday of his death that he only had sixpence to his name and they actually hadn't paid for all the alcohol that he'd drunk at Sutton's place. So we kind of only have like a bit of rumor and fun time saying that he had 300 pounds. We have testimony saying that he had sixpence.
And that's a big difference between sixpence and 350 pounds.
That's pretty.
That's a lot.
Yes. And so all of Cox's papers and personal effects were collected and examined, and there was no evidence that he ever sold a bunch of timber. So there was no invoice or receipt or like thanks for the timber, mate, or anything like that. And then there was also no information about how Maine paid for the butcher shop. So the whole thing is that he stole the money, he bought the butcher shop, then he became rich and famous, right?
Right.
Famous, I might be exaggerating. He became rich.
Infamous.
Rich and infamous. That should be the title of this podcast.
Yes.
So there's no evidence. There's no evidence to say that he used stolen money, and there's no evidence to say that he used regular non-stolen money. And also, Maine didn't pay like sticker price for the butcher shop establishment. He didn't pay... like he didn't buy the shop. He bought the goodwill of the butcher shop, which is basically like you pay the value of like the good name of the butcher shop and the customer base, like what that's worth. That's what you pay. And the guy who was selling the butcher shop was like, I'm not making any money. I don't want this butcher shop anymore. Here you go. So he probably didn't actually pay all that much for it.
No.
So very interesting. So establishment on Queen Street, like around the same time and location, cost around 240 pounds, which fits nicely into that 300 pound category. But yeah, he did not buy the actual establishment. So he could have just paid a small amount of money for this butcher shop and then got crazy rich from those three shipfuls of immigrants that came.
Wanting stew.
Those stew needing Irish folk who came not long after.
I love a stew.
So 99.9% of the information from this episode came from a book called The Maine Inheritance, which was written by Rosamund Simon in 1997, link in the show notes. This is the book that kind of made the story popular, and I think probably why there are so many like Maine ghost tour things that you can do in Brisbane, because it wasn't necessarily the most known story before then. So the book really hinges on the fact that Patrick Maine allegedly confessed to this crime on his deathbed.
Who did he confess it to?
Exactly, Jess. Who did he confess it to? It never says in the book. It says that he confessed on his deathbed, and then at the point of his dying, she lists a whole bunch of people who like could have popped in to see him and stuff like that, but she never says, and then he confessed to old mate. Just says that he confessed on his deathbed.
Says who, Rosamund?
She had claimed at one point in time.
Was she there?
Yes, she's a time traveler. She had claimed at one point in time that she had seen the diary that Maine's priest kept in a library and said that she had seen the entry relating to the confession.
Right.
But then somebody else was like, seems suspicious. And she was like, oh, yeah, well, I saw it, but it was upside down, so I can actually read it, but I know it can take confession. And then later on she was like, no, I didn't see.
She fibbed.
I think she told a fib.
Jesus. Yes. You can't just do that and write a book.
Yes, you can't just do that and write a book. I'll also have a link to that situation so you can verify that I'm not just slandering this woman's good name for shits and giggles on this podcast. The book is great. It's really well written, lots of information. There's a few things like the confession that she just goes, and then he confessed. And then I'm like, I just wrote a full chapter about like how much butcher premises cost and all this bullshit about, you know, and you can't tell me who he actually confessed to. I've read the address of every property Patrick Mayne owned in the entirety of Brisbane and surrounds, and you can't tell me who he confessed the murder to, lady. Like, come on. Yes. Not that I'm in my feelings about it.
No, not at all.
Yes. So she states it over and over again. There's only two like historical references to a confession. Like from history. The first was from 1888, which was 40 years after the actual murder and 23 years after the confession, which was in the book The Genesis of Queensland, written by Henry Stuart Russell. And basically he said, this guy died and an innocent man was hung, and somebody said, I watched that guy get hung instead of me and I did it. But he doesn't name
who it was.
Who it was. And again, in 1895, another confession. The confession was mentioned again in a different book, In the Early Days by John James Knight, who also didn't reference any confessor by name. It kind of said like, oh, we'll never speak his name again. So if it was such common knowledge that Mayne killed Cox, and that's why everybody was a little bit questionable about him, and also he had died 30 years prior to the point of you publishing your book, why would you not publish that information? Why would you not be like, and it was Patrick Mayne what done killed him? Like, just to be dramatic, just to be like, oh, I'm going to write this book where I say that somebody, like, let an innocent man get hung, but I'm going to wait 100 years for somebody else to write a book and she's going to actually say, you know, who it was that had done it. So we've got a confession that probably didn't happen. Two sources saying that an innocent man was hung for the crime and somebody else confessed to it, but they don't actually say who it was. I don't think, Patrick.
Don't you?
No. I definitely don't think there's enough evidence to say it. It
sounds very convenient for this guy. Like, I felt bad for Fife.
Yeah.
But then you think about it, you're like, you lived there. The blood was in the room. If it wasn't you, do you hear anybody?
How did you not hear somebody get dismembered in your backyard?
Yeah.
You know? And there wasn't like a point. Yeah. No, I don't reckon. So
I think it's a great story.
Great story. Great story. Part of the reason why the story lives on the way it does, we touched on at the start of the episode, Patrick Mayne had five children. They all had singularly depressing lives. They all chose to remain unmarried. Rosamund Simon, the author of the book, says it's because they made some kind of pact that like...
Didn't they have a sickness?
Yeah, the sickness was like the insanity, the madness.
Right.
So she says that, yeah, they all were like, okay, well, the madness stops with us, basically. Two of his children did suffer from some kind of mental illness, definitely. Rosanna and Isaac Mayne, they both – Rosanna was a sister at Sisters of Mercy and in her later life was quite unwell. She had to be physically restrained at all times. Isaac Mayne had been a solicitor, but he had to quit all that business. And he was in asylums and deteriorated very badly in his middle ages and ended up hanging himself. So it's James and Mary Amelia Mayne who are the more famous Maynes to us these days. So it was these two who decided to, as a gift, purchase a big block of land at St. Lucia and donate it to the university. So they didn't, as the story often goes, they didn't own UQ, they didn't buy UQ, they owned the land, they bought the land and donated it to the unit. If you go on a ghost tour, this is the point that they'll
ghost tour.
I feel like I know last episode we were like, let's go on a ghost tour, but now that I've read and done all this information about the Maynes, I can't participate in that.
Why? Because, are you scared?
No, I'm not scared. I just don't think that there was anything mysterious or ghostly about it. So yeah, so the Mayne children who were often referred to as like the Mad Maynes, everything like that. And I mean, two of them suffered from mental illness. They were a bit kooky, but I don't think calling them, apart from the two ones that were mentally ill who were mentally ill. The other ones, they were just like not, you know, they just didn't get married. You know what I mean? They weren't that kooky.
Yeah, yeah.
Rosamund Simon says that the bad reputation followed them throughout their lives, and there was all this drama that the university like didn't actually want them to buy them the land because they didn't want to be associated with the Maines and the bad reputation and the murder and blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't find... She lists all her sources in the book, which is very nice. She spoke to some people whose like grandparents were alive at the time and parents were alive at the time and stuff like that, and who remembered the Maines, and did say that people were like, oh, well, they thought they were a little bit weird. But I couldn't kind of independently verify any sort of like, everybody knew that Patrick Maine murdered somebody and they were all crazy as cut snakes and they were all spooky as all hell kind of reputation. So I think what has happened with this case is that nothing happened. Everybody chatted about it. It's 150 odd years later and we're still chatting about it. And everything has just Chinese whispered into the most enormous nonsense. I just don't think that you can say Patrick Maine confessed to killing somebody.
No.
When you don't have any evidence to say it.
See, this is exactly what you mean, like the Chinese whisper thing. I thought he had actually confessed to someone and it was confirmed.
Not confirmed.
Exactly. Like, that's what I thought had happened. And then the madness thing, like, I thought, I don't know, I thought I'd heard someone say that there was syphilis and they couldn't.
Well, people did think, because one of the symptoms of syphilis is that you go a bit nutso at the end. So one, we don't know how Patrick Maine died. We just know that he got sick. He was acting odd and then he died fairly quickly.
What happened to his wife?
His wife is actually an OG, and I'm glad you brought her up. So she, after Patrick Maine died, she was like, well, I'm technically head of the household now. And she was just really smart with business and management and stuff like that. So he had a huge debt to the Bank of New South Wales. He had all these other things that were just not going quite right. People were like, Mary, sell everything now. And she was like, I'm going to wait. And I'm going to sell things when the time is right. And so she like recouped back their fortune.
Oh, wow.
So by just waiting until the right time to sell certain businesses. Like, so she kept the butcher shop for a really long time up until it became too intense for her to have to care for. And then she, you know, she kept some agricultural lands for a while and then sold it when it was most proper. Like,
going to be most profitable. Good for Mary.
Yeah, she was really, really cool. All the siblings were quite... All the main children see like quite interesting people who all did, you know.
Yeah.
Old, like one was a nun, one was a solicitor, one was a doctor.
Even though the majority of it could be made up.
You could read the book.
Yeah, I will. I'm interested now that I know that mainly all that I... Mainly! That the shit I know is probably just rumor and conjecture.
It's probably not true.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Excellent work.
That's my consensus. Sorry to everybody in Brisbane. I've decided that Patrick Maine didn't kill that. It just doesn't really make sense.
I mean, it's nice to have, well, it's not nice, but like it's...
It's a great legend and a great story.
Yeah, it's interesting to have legends like that and like, I don't know, it gives our town like a bit of character, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think with all these legends and stuff like that, once you peel it back and see what it's based on...
It's quite normal.
It's quite... Usually not much.
Guy killed a guy because it's just...
Maybe. And also maybe there wasn't any money and
maybe there wasn't...
I was about to say, and maybe nothing happened, but Robert Cox did die.
He did die.
R.I.P. Robert Cox.
Yeah, sorry, dude.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Murder. Do you have any final thoughts?
I just thought you did a good job.
Thanks. Good. I'm glad. Yeah. Thank you to all of our listeners.
Oh, my God. As of today, so we film these. We record these 2 weeks in advance from us releasing them-ish. So it's like the 25th of July now, and we got our numbers at the start of the week, and we have over 1,000 subscribers, which is
insane.
Completely nutso.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling your friends.
Oh, it's so cool.
Thank you for liking our Facebook page.
Yeah. Please engage with us more. I posted a thing and I was like expecting people to write stuff and they didn't. People liked it and that's great, but like...
Please validate us through social media.
Please.
We would appreciate it.
And remember,
a lot.
You can send us, and as Ellen mentioned, you can email us at murderintheland@gmail.com. You can let us know what we really would like to know, or what I would like to know is, because we've got one more case before we finish in Queensland. If there's any Queensland cases that we missed,
and bear we can in come mind back to
something that I want people to understand with how we choose our cases is And I don't know if I speak for Ellen, but I speak for myself that I don't really want to do too much that involves children.
Nope.
I find it very distressing and I just don't think it's very, I don't know. I just don't want to talk about it. So bear that in mind. If you have any interesting cases that you would like us to talk about or, you know, revisit, we could do like a short, like 20 minute and read your emails about cases that you're interested in because we would really like to know.
Absolutely. And if there's any cases that you think we'd be interested in but maybe don't necessarily have enough meat for a whole episode, we can do a little app.
A little mini episode?
A little mini app just for you.
Yeah.
Please contact us. We're so lonely.
Fifi's episode.
Fifi chats.
Oh, she's digging her claws into me. She knew I was talking about her. So we have one more episode in Queensland. We decided to do an extra episode after my good friend of the podcast, Jonathan Hickey, let me know about this thing. And then I spoke to my mother about it. And when this had happened, my parents actually were on their honeymoon. And so she was like, oh my gosh, yes, you should so talk about that. Is the basically the title of the case is going to be the Brisbane Lesbian Vampire Killer. Which, you know.
Lesbian vampire killers. Woo! We're doing it. Not that it's fun and exciting.
No, it's not. But I didn't really know much about it. So we're going to tackle that in the next case. And then we move on to New South Wales.
So exciting. What? I've lived in New South Wales, so I will still have some personal connections.
I have not. And I dislike Sydney.
Everybody dislikes Sydney. No offense, but fuck Sydney.
I mean, Brisbane's the worst, but at least our, like, footpaths like aren't so worn down by people that they're slippy slidey because like I fall over every time I go to Sydney.
Come on, Sydney, no joke. Fix your footpaths. Also, your housing situation is out of control.
Yeah, that's mental.
We'll see you next fortnight
for the Brisbane Lesbian Vampire Killer.
We'll miss you.
Bye.
My name's Liz Keogh and I have my life together.
My name's Curtis Lang and by all rights, I shouldn't be alive.
And I want to find out what it's like to walk 1 mile in your shoes.
Fair enough. If that's what you really want, then that's on you. I'm just so concerned for you, Liz. What are we going to do in this podcast?
We're going to be swapping friends, diets, cars, phones, underwears, jobs.
Oh, man. Have you ever seen Freaky Friday? It's pretty much that film. We're going to swap, these aspects of our lives and... Oh, man, I'm really concerned for how it's going to turn out for you, let me tell you.
Yes, well, we are going to be every Friday dropping those ones, so put it in your diaries, put them in your calendars, in your notes.
I definitely keep a diary and a calendar. That's definitely something I do.
I do. I have my life together, Curtis.
Well, I don't. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.